Do you know every independent bookshop in your city? When going someplace new, do you first Google the nearest library? Do you currently own more books than you do cleaning supplies? Have you only read one quarter of the books you own? Do you have frequent nightmares that someone will steal your books and dog-ear the pages? Do you look down on people who use a Kindle? You may be suffering from bibliomania.
It's a disease for which there is no cure. But if I had to choose to have an incurable disease with only one prognosis, the pleasure of books for the rest of my life, I'll take it.
Hi, I'm Katie Marquette. And if you think you might have bibliomania, you're not alone. I definitely have it. My entire basement is filled with boxes of books. I never have enough bookcases. I just love books. And today on the Noir and Bizarre, it's going to be all about books. Weird books, scary books, noir books, beautiful books, lost books, you name it. Because at the end of September, it's Baltimore's amazing book festival. If you haven't been before, now is the year you have to go. And on today's episode, we're going behind the scenes on a tour of one of the most beautiful libraries in the entire world, Baltimore's Peabody Library. I actually was able to record the exact moment I entered the library.
Believe it. I've never seen so many books in all my life.
You like it?
It's wonderful.
Then it's yours.
Just kidding. And weirdly enough, they didn't offer to give me the library, which I thought was kind of rude. But either way, if the Beast giving Belle her own library is still your idea of the most romantic gesture in the world, you're really going to enjoy this episode. My inspiration came from a visit I took to the library where I saw a feature all about bibliomania. Bibliomania is not classified as a disease per se, but people have been psychologically treated for it. Bibliomania involves severe book hoarding, anxiety over the well-being of your books, maybe even having nightmares about people taking your books. Like I said, I definitely have it, and someone else who does is a man named Earl Havens. He's the curator of rare books at the Peabody Library. On this episode, Earl is going to introduce us to some seriously bizarre books housed in the library, and he's also going to acquaint us with a bit of the history surrounding this stunning cathedral of books. Stay tuned.
You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve?
They're demons!
Experience the excitement, the danger.
But it would be slightly more difficult to pull off now, though, don't you think?
My name is Earl Havens. I am the Nancy Hall Curator of Rare Books and Manuscripts at Johns Hopkins University.
Well, this is a beautiful space up here.
It is. It's a big secret.
Yeah, we've found this sort of hidden room upstairs. It's so this is the Rare Books Library up here.
It's been separated from the general circulating, well, not really circulating, because nothing circulates, which is why most of the books are still here. But these have been segregated from, let's say, the less rare material, which is distributed across all the shelves that one sees as one enters the library. These are in a double secure space, and they are pretty extensive. This is just one of several rare book library collections that we have at Johns Hopkins University as well. So this represents a portion of the larger collection.
These books, they're so beautiful, so ornate, so much detail. Is this something, you know, as you said, so expensive? Would this be something that somebody would very proudly display in their home if they were able to afford it?
It would. You'd have to have a very large coffee table for it. But you would definitely have had it prominently displayed in your library, in your palace, right? Or palaces. And indeed, we know of several collections that possessed copies of this in the great houses of counts and cardinals of the church. And it was also something very special because the library in somebody's house was, in a way, a portrait of that collector. It was a representation of their interests. And indeed, the collection of the George Peabody Library is fundamentally an expression of the ideas represented in these publications in my hands. This being the founding letter of the Peabody Institute in 1857, and here the published letter expressing George Peabody's wishes Normally, this is signed. His name appears in type, but in this special copy, George Peabody signed it with his hand to present it to the library's collection. And in it, he gives his gift of hundreds of thousands of dollars to the city of Baltimore, to the trustees of the George Peabody Institute, to create its first true public cultural institution.
And what year was that?
1857, which was a very tricky time in our history. In fact, the Institute itself would not open its doors until 1866. 1868, when it started to get moving. And then very quickly, by the 1870s, it was realized that it needed to be much expanded into the library that we have here now in Mount Vernon today, in that absolutely glorious library.
How different is it today? I mean, with people being able to self-publish and, you know, the internet makes it so that you can basically publish anywhere, anytime you want. What has changed in the publishing process, and is it more democratic now? What's lost? What's gained?
I think it's a lot has been lost, a lot has been gained, a lot's still the same. It's a big, hot mess, much as it was when Johannes Gutenberg invented the technology of print by movable type. There was, among some, a great resistance, a sense of the vulgarity, the vulgarization of knowledge, that, oh, any Joe can go out and print a book now. Sound familiar? You know? Also, this idea that there were suddenly too many books, a kind of information overload, to quote a colleague of mine, Ann Blair. Well, that didn't all just happen in our generation. This happened 500 years ago, and we have a lot to learn from that, how the things, what had been lost for them and what had been gained. But at the end of the day, I think it's useful to think of the book as a work of art and as a technology at one and the same time. I don't know that we necessarily think of that as much anymore. Everything that you see in front of you was made by hand. The paper, made by hand, literally. The leather on the bindings, this is a tooled leather binding on a wooden board. The tree was chopped down by somebody. The goat was slaughtered. Somebody made the dies that created the decorative designs, which were heated and then rolled onto the board. Somebody made the raised bands out of a textile yarn. Somebody bound it all together. Somebody else made the ink. Somebody else founded each of the different kinds of type, the Germanic type, the Roman type. And of course, there were the artists who engraved these against samples. We know that scientists like Aldrovandi carried this gigantic book, or had a servant carry this gigantic book, up a mountain while he went on a specimen hunt for plants, for exotic plants. So there's something remarkable about that, that is a world that we're still trying to recover even evidence of, how this impact happened. And the only place where you can really do that is here, in the library. Unfortunately, we're no longer able to take this 16th century book up a mountainside with us. Well, though I'm sure it would be very useful.
I'm sure it would. I mean, you know, when people complain now about taking books on an airplane, you know, they want to take the Kindle instead. So, you know, little perspective here.
A little perspective. It is a little too big.
Yeah.
In fact, we have a copy of the largest book, the double elephant folio of Audubon's Birds of America, which would probably require all three of us just to operate, let alone to read or to look at. So some books were clearly designed to be absolutely spectacularly lavish. Why not? I sometimes refer to some of these books, like these hand-colored books over here, as book bling.
How many books are in this library?
Well, it's difficult to answer that question, in part because what is a book? We have cuneiform tablets that are not exactly books. We have whole runs of periodicals. Is that 80 volume item one book, or is it? We also have the Encyclopédie of Diderot and D'Alembert that was produced in the French Enlightenment in the original boards. That's one book, although it exists in over 20 volumes. Including all the wonderful volumes at the end with all the illustrations. Buying a copy of the Encyclopédie was not distant from the prospect of buying a house in the 18th century. That's how expensive the book was. And so when you ordered up your copy, you would very often have it bound up in beautiful leather boards with gold leaf compartments above, between the raised bands, specially stamped leather with the title, and beautiful treated boards with sumptuous watermarks, so that the book becomes a work of art, as well as a compendium of all of human knowledge at the same time. And as you go through the book, you can see that it's very looks like it was printed yesterday. If you touch the paper, you'll see that it's printed on textile. It's printed on rag. So it's much thicker than anything we would normally consider. And if you feel it like through on both sides, you can feel the raised letter forms from the letterpress process.
Wow.
So the book is really a sumptuous work of art. It is a representation of the apex of human achievement in the production of knowledge and in the technology and art through which knowledge is relayed, primarily, that is, through books. Until the digital age, these physical objects constituted the primary means through which all human knowledge was transmitted, was read, was consumed, was imitated, censored, and so forth and so on for centuries. Mm-hmm. And so we're very lucky to be able to preserve them. This over here is the famous Nuremberg Chronicle. The Nuremberg Chronicle was printed 1 year after Christopher Columbus discovered the New World in 1493. This was owned by Anton Fugger, one of the great banking family members, the Fugger family. And it is literally a history of the world from the 6 days creation, according to the Judeo-Christian Bible, to the end of the world and the apocalypse, all in one book. So here's God in heaven. Here are little blank spots for you to paint your arms, your coat of arms. And then that is the creation. So you just have circles. Here you have two circles. Here you have six circles. And then you have the stars and the heavens. And then you have the birds, the fishes, Adam from the clay, and the universe. And it's a composite of all the major known encyclopedic works of literature and history, including the Bible itself. And it quickly becomes a lot of the biblical begetting, the great family tree, so to speak, that we read about. They're actually literally Noah and his sons of Noah are listed as almost as a tree coming through time. And then it becomes a history of the founding of cities, including Nuremberg, which is this page, where this book was printed. And then you get to the year 1493, it becomes a very curious little book. It stops. And here it says, you have reached the sixth age. We are living in the sixth age, by
Still.
The way. Yes. I think you might have heard Gandalf the Grey say this in The Hobbit or whatever.
Absolutely.
But here is the end of the sixth age. So you can continue to write the history of the world as it happens to you on these pages very conveniently.
And so far it's blank.
It's blank. Unfortunately, almost all copies are blank. There are one or two that have writing on them. But you only need six pages because that should be enough until before the end of the world.
Six ages, pretty close.
Six pages between now and the apocalypse. It gives you a tremendous sense of the imminence of the doom, the end, the sense that the world was going to come to an end. 1493 was 7 years away from a round number, the year 1500. I'm old enough to remember the Y2K scare in December 31st, 1999.
All the computers were going to shut down and...
Yeah, and there were suicide pacts with radical religious organizations, and this sense of the end of days. But here in this book, you can absorb that culture in a way that you just can't experience in I think any other place or way more viscerally, more immediately, than in the pages of a 15th century book as you turn them. That is a first edition of Darwin's Origin of the Species. We have three copies of this book. It was not a rare book when it came out. This is the New York edition, not the London edition, but it's still worth hundreds of thousands of dollars in excellent condition. And ours is in excellent condition way up there. But of course, when we bought it when it came out, for a dollar.
A dollar.
Yeah. So that's one of the ways in which great rare book collections are made. They're made in time. They're made way back in time when things were much less valuable.
Like wine collecting.
Like wine or property, a certain sort of parts of cities that become incredibly expensive over time and have permanent value. It is something like that. That's right.
We're looking right now at an advertisement, looks like, that says Great American Mastodon now exhibiting at the hall.
That's correct. That exists in only one or two other copies. It represents the discovery, and there were several such discoveries in upstate New York, of intact mastodons. And these, of course, became the ultimate thing to have in your museum. And in fact, Baltimore had one of the very first museums in America, and its most common draw, its most famous draw, was not a Tyrannosaurus Rex. We didn't have any of those, I don't think, in the early 19th century. But in Peale's Museum, there was a mastodon. And so we decided to acquire that broadside as a reflection of the kind of sensation that would cause people to come to places like that as destinations.
Sort of the reason I wanted to talk to you was one day I was here and I saw out in your front area, you have a little sort of information placard with Bibliomania as the headline. And there's a great drawing along with it that I don't remember who did it, but it has sort of a man, he's sleeping and he's having nightmares about people, like little goblins, like chopping up his books. And I just loved that.
It was a wonderful find in a book by Charles Nodier, who was a great and accomplished librarian at the period of the French Revolution. And there were a group of book collectors who wished to publish his satire called The Bibliomaniac. And it's absurd. This poor man, who is the main character, basically is obsessed with books. He can't do anything other than collect them. He even dreams about them. And he wants only books in the most pristine style. He takes a micrometer around to see whether his copy of a particularly small imprint is actually smaller than or larger than the one that the bookseller has. And if it one is different than the other, he must have them both, that kind of thing. And here is a nightmare that one of our graduate students, Neil Ware, found when he was doing research for our exhibition. And it represents two men, two rather unfortunate-looking figures. They look sort of demoniacal. They are Purgold and Houdier, and they did two of the worst things you could possibly imagine to rare books. He is bleaching pages. He's taken a book apart and bleached the pages to make them look like they should, like they did when they originally were printed, as white as the driven snow, with the text coming out really beautifully versus these older, grubbier kinds of copies. And then his partner is rebinding the books. And in order to rebind any book, you have to trim it, as you can see here, so that the margins are not very generous. And so this man is trimming violently a beautiful copy of an Aldus Minucius Incunabulum, a Greek imprint of the 15th century. And of course, all of this is happening in a dream cloud, a nightmare cloud, above our poor character, the bibliomaniac.
And it says something here.
His wife thought that he was talking Greek because he knew a little Greek. And as a proof of his knowledge, three shelves in his library were filled with Greek books with uncut leaves. So he's talking about the fact that he does actually have uncut leaves.
Right. So and it looks like here he's talking about the monsters are cutting them up, and he has good reason to think that they are at least both in purgatory.
And that's kind. I would have expected.
I think they're lower down.
I think they would have expected a special level of Dante's Inferno for them. But nonetheless, that is a very charming example of the kind of obsession of the book collector. So bibliomania represents a kind of culture of the late 18th and the early 19th century when books, it became the ultra fashionable thing to do is to buy extremely expensive rare books. And people's, their prices for certain books that were paid in the 18 teens that have never been matched again for certain titles. So it was truly the age of bibliomania. We're walking out of the rare book room.
Goodbye, beautiful room.
And we'll go into the nitty-gritty stack area. Oop. This is our high-tech door stopper here. Watch your step. And stand away from the rail because it's not correctly, it's historically should be higher.
Yeah, we're walking along and we're sort of looking down at the library right now. And it's not a very high railing, is it? No.
No, it's not. It's a beautiful railing in a kind of Corinthian style that's derived from a pattern book, actually, that we have in the library. These beautiful cast iron elements, this Beaux-Art material. But it is amazing, just by standing on the third floor, how you see everything differently than you would have when you came in. And this is a closed stack library, non-lending research library. So the disadvantage of that is that not everyone can wander around and hang from these things like playful children. But it also means that all the books are still here for the most part.
And that is the primary goal, is to protect the books but make them, you know, you can come here and you can, yeah, I mean, we're looking down. I mean, people come here, they're studying, they, you know, do people sort of just find this to be a quiet place to work, you know, good thoughts come out
from
of this
all
place.
From all over, this is a public space and we have public exhibitions. The next one will be in the fall, and others just come and use these beautiful desks just to absorb the quiet and the space and the air conditioning.
Very appealing.
Yeah, yeah, and that is what it was for.
Wow, yeah, this is beautiful. I hope you enjoyed our tour of a bibliomaniac's paradise, the Peabody Library. You can visit the library for yourself here in Baltimore. I guarantee you, you'll be amazed and inspired. Thanks again to the rare book curator, Earl Havens, for sharing his love of books with us. On our next episode of The Noir and Bizarre, we're continuing our celebration of books, this time talking with prolific author Howard Norman. His books deal with noir themes, lost loves, murder, detectives, flashbacks. If you want to get to know his work before the next episode drops, I highly recommend a book called Next Life Might Be Kinder. It's one of my favorite books ever. A man's wife has been murdered. We know this from page one. But he still sees her and talks to her. She's stacking books on the beach behind his house and is afraid to tell him about her death. Seriously, it's a really beautiful book, and we talk about it a lot in the next episode. Make sure you subscribe to The Noir and Bizarre now so you don't miss future episodes. And give us a rating on iTunes if you're liking what you hear. The Noir and Bizarre is an original WYPR production, hosted and produced by me, Katie Marquette. Until next time, thanks for listening.